Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, May 23rd. Today we talk about insurance. Companies across the state are starting to hike their premiums or are limiting coverage on types of properties they're willing to take on. We unpack Maui's Minutoya list, the list of short-term rentals soon to be phased out for long-term housing. We hear more about the curator of the Royal Mausoleum following pushback from Native Hawaiian groups about cultural considerations. And the world of theater gives a nod to Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. Confest 2024 is set to debut a new play set in post-fire Lahaina. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. At noon today, the Hawaii Economic Association will hold a webinar to focus on condominium issues. In a world of climate uncertainty, insurance companies are raising rates to cover risk and replacement costs. 20 years ago, the Manoa Valley flood caused more than $1 million in damages, and that storm was not a full-blown hurricane. To put it in context, Hurricane Iniki in 1992 cost $3 billion in damage, and the Maui wildfires are estimated at twice that. Back in 2010, J.P. Schmidt was the state's insurance commissioner, and he had just convinced an insurance company from Korea, Dongbu, to set up shop in Hawaii. Schmidt also served as Maui County Corporation Counsel. He now heads up the firm Baris Global. We reached out to him at his Denver office to get his take on things.
Insurance companies have had to deal with much higher risks than they had anticipated. And a lot of that is due to global warming, climate change, I guess. I have not seen that companies are moving out of Hawaii, and that's a good thing. In Florida and California and Louisiana, there are numerous property and casualty companies that are actually leaving the state because they just don't feel that they can price their premiums at a level in order to recoup losses, given the risks. They're all, to some degree, due to climate change, creating new and more violent, more expensive risks. But then there are also local conditions, local laws in each state that are problematic for the insurance companies. And so in Hawaii, we have to be aware of those difficulties and the difficulties that companies have with laws and requirements. The insurance commissioner, Gordon Ito, is a member of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. They meet numerous times. They meet at least 4 quarterly meetings, and then they have an international forum and a financial forum and other meetings as well. And the insurance commissioner can attend those and get a lot of useful information on how to best deal with the insurance market in Hawaii.
Yeah, I'm told by his office that he's at a conference probably doing that very thing. Given, you know, your experience as a commissioner here, and I remember at the time doing an interview with you when Dongbu entered the market, because mm-hmm. that gave property owners more options at the time. But we have very little control over, you know, these companies, right? Whether they decide to pull back on certain coverage or decide to leave the state or, you know, stop writing policies for certain zip codes.
Yeah, well, the companies do have freedom to decide whether or not they're going to take on the risk, whether or not they're going to write the policies. However, their freedom is quite limited because we do have extensive regulations. One of those is that they have to get their rates approved. How much they charge their customers and premiums has to be approved by the insurance commissioner. And there aren't many industries or businesses where the government has to approve what they're going to charge for their product. And there are a number of consumer-oriented rules and regulations to ensure that they're dealing with the consumer fairly. Now, I just read that in Louisiana that they're having problems, and some of the solutions the commissioner there is suggesting, I think, are not good. One is that they would allow some insurance companies to write without prior approval of their rates. The thing is that the commissioner understands that one of the worst things that can happen for consumers is if the insurance company goes insolvent. Then, of course, it's not providing any new policies, and it has to, what's called run out or evaluate all the claims that have occurred prior to their insolvency, and that often takes years. And people often are not reimbursed well in that kind of process. When I was commissioner, we actually had very great success with several companies that had gone insolvent. We had stepped in and secured assets and were able to pursue lawsuits against other companies or directors and officers that we should have done a better job or not doing the right thing. And we were able to wind up two or three estates with over 100% reimbursement back to the policyholders, which certainly at the time was very, very unusual. We did a good job with that. You mentioned Dongbu.
Yes.
That was an example where when I had gone to an NAIC meeting, I became aware of a model law. The NAIC develops model laws of what they think would be good regulation, and then it's up to each state's legislature to adopt that law or not, or change it. And I became aware of port of entry model law that they had, which allows foreign companies to come in to do business in the state, makes it easier for them to come in. And so I got that model law enacted by the state legislature, and Dongbu thought, hey, that's a good idea. We should start up a company in Hawaii, and we'll learn a lot about the American insurance market.
And since that time, Dongbu, now known as DB Insurance, expanded to New York City and now has offices across the country. We asked Schmidt what he thought Hawaii ought to be doing, since there are real concerns that this could hamper efforts to rebuild Maui and to make headway with our affordable housing crisis.
Well, the insurance commissioner needs to communicate and talk with the insurers. I think my predecessor had a rule he wouldn't talk to insurers. When I came in, I said, hey, I have an open door. Insurance companies provide an absolutely necessary product for people, and it's a very complex area, and I want to hear what you have to say. And they appreciated that a lot. I also looked very closely at premium, any requests for premium increases to try to protect consumers, as well as the other regulations we have to protect consumers. So, I think I had more of a working together relationship with everyone, and it seemed to go well. Right now, the legislature, what the legislature was looking at or passed was to do a study, and, studying the problem is always good, but that doesn't necessarily result in something happening. And so the insurance commissioner should talk to consumers, groups of consumers, to determine what the problem is, talk to insurance companies to see, what their status is, and in my view, work together to provide a solution. Because if some companies are not offering policies, or some consumers are having a very difficult time getting policies, that can upset the market and hurt other consumers and other insurance companies that might not directly be seeing the problem. So he needs to take a look at that and talk to them.
If property owner is having a tough time getting someone, get a mortgage on their property, I guess they've got to wait for a cash buyer, which can be tricky. Yeah. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see if there is a need to see what happens, I guess, and then if there's a need for a special session to take more direct action.
In order to get something done fairly quickly, they would have to actually pass a law in the special section not just a resolution for a study, in order to try to get a solution done quickly. Unfortunately, in insurance, everything has tendency to move quite slowly. But, you know, there are a variety of solutions. Louisiana commissioner about 20 years ago had a really difficult situation because of a hurricane that hit, Hurricane Katrina. And he did a very good job in stabilizing the market and helping to get things back on track. Florida and Louisiana have established a citizens insurance company. And what that is if people can't get hurricane insurance, which they need for their mortgages and what have you, they can get it from this state-owned agency, insurance company, Citizens Insurance. That poses some challenges in that, you know, you do have to fund it.
Right.
And if you have, Florida and Louisiana have seen where they've had a disaster afterwards and they got a flood of people into the citizens coverage and they had to work quickly to make sure that they were able to take care of those people and take care of their claims.
I think one big concern is that, if there is a problem with the property insurance, that could really hurt our recovery on Maui, and it could also really hurt our efforts toward building more housing across the state.
Just about everybody has to have insurance of some kind, and so it's very important and it's essential to the economy and certainly to people's lives. And I always kept that in mind in, you know, looking at the various challenges that would come up and looking at what a good solution would be. The main thing is that the insurance division has very capable people in it. They have very skilled, very well-trained, capable people in it. And so it's very important for everyone to talk with the commissioner and talk with the people in the division what would be the best way forward.
That was former State Insurance Commissioner J.P. Schmidt, now principal of Abaris Global, weighing in on the state of property insurance given the risks associated with climate change. This issue is fast evolving. The Hawaii Economic Association is holding a webinar to better understand the condo insurance market. Starting at noon today, it will feature State House Speaker Scott Saiki and the Hawaii Insurance Council's Mike Onofredi. The conversation is planning a call-in show on this issue next week. Do you have an insurance story to share with us? Call our talkback line and record something. We can include it in our coverage.
In 2003, then-pastor Beth Stroud revealed her sexuality to her church congregation.
Coming out felt like I was being true to my calling.
The United Methodist Church disagreed. Stroud was defrocked. Well, 20 years later, as many members have left the church, the UMC is reconsidering its stance on sexuality. That's on the next On Point.
This afternoon at 2, following The Daily.
Aloha. This is Steve Curwood, host of Living on Earth. Each week, we discuss the challenges of climate disruption, but we also look for solutions and ways to cope and thrive. And it brings us special joy to showcase the wonders of nature and the spectacular biodiversity of the planet we call home. So join me tonight at 6:30 here on HPR One.
The Maui wildfire disaster has triggered a bold move to convert short-term rentals into long-term housing. The focus of that is the Minatoya list. Here to drill down on that list and to tell us more is HPR reporter Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
So explain to our listeners again, what is this Minatoya list?
So the Minatoya list is something that we've heard a lot about lately. It consists of apartments or units in apartment-zoned districts on Maui. And officials say they were previously used as workforce housing, and they are operating legally as short-term rentals through an exemption that was provided years ago. And so the county's goal in proposed legislation that would go into effect potentially next year would be to, the mayor said, you know, convert those units back to their original purpose. So residential housing, workforce housing being used for residents of Maui rather than as short-term vacation rentals. And so I spoke with Matt Jahowski, who is Director of Data Technology and Innovation at the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement. He has done a lot of work gathering data on housing on Maui, but recently particularly focusing on this Minutoya list. So Maui County has 13,700 almost legal short-term rentals, and the Minutoya properties are about 45% of that number. The county doesn't know how many illegal rentals, short-term rentals, are in operation. There are quite a few, but for the legal rentals, it's almost 14,000. And there are 7,000 units on this Minutoya list. He notes that only about a little over 6,000 of them are short-term rentals that would be affected by this legislation. The rest are mostly owner-occupied or long-term rentals already, but, you know, a relatively small amount for that designation. Over 90% of them are one- and two-bedroom units in apartment or condo buildings. So we're talking about mostly, you know, condo units. And they're almost all located in South Maui and West Maui, about 95% of them. So that's the area that we're looking at here that would be affected. A majority of them are actually in Kihei, which is interesting. And a total of 2,200 of them are totaled in West Maui. Jahowski looked at the tax impacts to Maui County if this legislation goes through.
People correctly point out that short-term rentals generate a lot of tax revenue for Maui County. Just the short-term rentals in this Minutoya list would contribute about $70 million in taxes, property taxes this year. That's not actually the case because some of them are getting that wildfire property tax exemption. You know, assume that didn't exist, they'd be contributing about $70 million in taxes. And depending on what, you know, what they change into, whether they become non-owner occupied, like second homes for people, or whether they become owner occupied or long-term rentals, we're going to see a reduction of like $30 to $50 million in property tax. And if you look at the county's proposed budget for 2025, that's a reduction of 2.5% to 4%. So that's the amount that it would impact the county's budget.
So that's a bit of a hit.
It is. But the mayor has said, you know, it's the right thing to do. And a lot of those taxes may be made up in other ways. For example, you know, all properties are taxed. And so, you know, it's not like it would be a complete loss. For example, you know, conversions to long-term rentals would still be taxed just at a lower rate. It's also important to note that it's unclear how many of these units will actually become available as rentals for Maui residents, which, of course, is sort of the overarching goal here. Jahowski is suggesting, you know, incentives because people could hold on to those units, you know, perhaps move into them as you know, retirement homes. They could sell them, or of course, you know, they could convert them into long-term rentals. So there's a lot of unknowns here still. One of the interesting data sets that Jahowski looked at was where owners are from based on their mailing address.
A lot of people have said, hey, there's, you know, local residents who own these rentals and operate them, and that's how they survive. So there are, and if you look at the data, 766 of these short-term rentals, which is about 12.5%, have owners with Maui County mailing addresses. So, you know, there are people who are residents will be impacted, but it's only 12.5%, which to me doesn't feel like an overwhelming number. We can see in the graph that the largest category of owners by far is Californians. We have a lot of other owners from Washington and Canada.
It'd be interesting to see if the county could survey those mainlanders just to, you know, figure out what they plan to do.
Yeah, like, you know, it would be interesting. Time will tell if this goes through, you know, looking at July 1st, 2025 as implementation date for West Maui specifically, and then January of 2026 for the rest of Maui, as the mayor has told us. And all of Matt Jahowski's data is available on helpingmaui.org. It's really interesting to see the breakdown of those numbers that he has gathered, really just taking, you know, a step back and looking at what the Minutoya list really is. I think there's a lot of misinformation, and just, you know, taking a look is interesting. So if you're interested, go check it out.
All right. And we'll have to see if any legal challenges pop up. But thanks so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
That was HVR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel talking about the move to phase out short-term vacation rentals to provide long-term rentals for Maui residents. Last week's flooding and heavy rains triggered brown water advisories, which had many wondering when would it be safe to swim in the ocean again. Well, a new study out was looking at bacteria levels at six of Hilo's popular swimming and surfing spots. Author and University of Hawaii at Hilo researcher Maria Stedman was surprised to see high levels of fecal bacteria at Hilo's Reeds Bay because there aren't as many cesspools or septic tanks nearby compared to a site like Puhi Bay. She spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender.
My research interests are mainly in water quality, so specifically looking at pathogenic bacteria or viruses in our coastal waters, so recreational waters. Because of my research, I've been really interested in pathogenic bacteria that might not be heavily studied or monitored by any federal or state agencies. So I really wanted to focus on the bacteria known as Staphylococcus aureus. It can be shortened to S. aureus or just Staph. And since moving to Hawaii in 2015, a lot of the community and people that I've met also would talk about how they would get staph infections very frequently, especially after swimming. So that kind of compelled me within my studies and also my research to further investigate how Staphylococcus aureus, you know, survives in recreational waters, where it could be the highest, and what factors may be influencing it.
Yeah, and that's super interesting that this started anecdotally of people telling you that they got staph infections from swimming. Do you have a sense of how big an issue that is in Hawaii specifically?
Definitely a larger problem than we think. And it was actually about 20 years ago when the state of Hawaii was leading the nation in staph infections, and specifically in the methicillin-resistant staph infection known as MRSA. So that's when it started to gain a lot of attention, but our rates went down since then that were, like, at least reported in, for example, hospitals or clinical settings. But that community-acquired staph infections, which you may get from swimming in the ocean, are generally underreported, and we still see, like, high amounts of those infections just from speaking to others. And I kind of have a saying where it's not if you're going to get a staph infection, it's when you're going to get an infection from swimming. One of the previous graduate students in our laboratory, one of the times that he went out to go sampling, he actually got a staph infection while sampling and looking for staph as well.
My understanding is that for maybe a lot of the people who get staph infections, if you have a healthy immune system, you're probably fine. But even so, not really a fun infection to have.
Staph, it can be found on about a quarter of the population at any given time. It generally is a natural part of the skin microbiome, so it can be found especially like in your nose or in your upper respiratory tract. And at that point, it's not infectious. But once there's an open wound or open cut, you can potentially get a staph infection by either giving it to yourself or touching an object with staph, or even swimming and it enters this wound and can cause like a skin infection or an ear infection. But generally they are treatable and they're not often severe infections. However, for those, you know, who might be immunocompromised or might be at higher risk. They can develop more severe staph infections. So to enter your body can cause sepsis, for example, so infecting your bloodstream, or even cause toxic shock syndrome in different cases. So yeah, staph, even though it's very common and we live with it every day, it's not something to be super afraid of, but definitely to be aware of the risk, especially if it is resistant to antibiotics.
Beaches and coastal waters where people are swimming, like what are the factors that might contribute to there being staph aureus or some of these other bacteria?
In my recent study, we were really interested, of course, in focusing in on Staphylococcus aureus. And we also wanted to look into fecal indicator bacteria. Fecal indicator bacteria are bacteria commonly found in human feces, and a lot of public health departments, both nationally and also among states, use these bacteria to determine whether there is sewage contamination in recreational waters. And so to answer some of these questions that we had, we focused in on Hawaii Islands Population Center, which is Hilo, and we focused on six popular beach sites at Hilo. So if you've heard of Honolii, which is a very popular surfing spot, and then Bayfront, which is very big for paddlers, then Reed's Bay, Pui Bay, Onakaka Beach Park, and Richardson Ocean Park, which are really common for swimming and other recreational activities. So what we did is we collected these seawater and sand samples, and we looked for those bacteria, so staph, MRSA, and those fecal indicators. And we also collected data on temperature, dissolved oxygen, salinity, and we also looked at some more factors, such as the abundance of on-site sewage disposal systems. We saw that staph and MRSA were generally higher at sites with the surface freshwater discharge, so sites like Honolii and Bayfront, which receive surface freshwater discharge from streams and rivers. And this may be due to the fact that not only humans can carry staph, but animals as well. And we both can shed these bacteria into soil, and that could be washed into these streams and through the watersheds that then discharge into the coast. But for our fecal indicator bacteria, one interesting result that we found was that they were generally highest at sites with submarine groundwater discharge. For example, like Reed's Bay, this site is notorious for having those cold, chilly waters, and as well as Pui Bay. We found that for staph, that there were higher concentrations around sites that had higher abundances of on-site sewage disposal systems as well. And so that could potentially lead to the hypothesis that the submarine groundwater discharge that's going into these coastal waters, these popular recreational beaches, are contaminated with wastewater from these leaky on-site sewage disposal systems, such as cesspools and septic tanks. And then another major factor that we've found was that these bacteria are positively associated with water turbidity. So as water turbidity increases, the water appears more murky or even brown in some cases. And so these bacteria concentrations are higher during these higher water turbidity events. And that could be simply due to there being less light penetrating, which can kill bacteria, or that they're potentially offering a source of organic nutrients for these bacteria to be able to persist and even replicate for longer in these recreational waters.
Mm.
So overall, we found that, you know, the conditions for concern to be really aware of is just swimming near areas where there's a lot of freshwater discharge. So swimming really close to river mouths might increase your chance of getting a staph infection. And then also being aware of areas with a lot of groundwater discharge and whether these areas have high abundances of cesspools or septic tanks near them. And that might also be a reason why we see higher fecal indicator bacteria at these coastal sites.
Were there any of these popular surf spots or recreational beaches that you were surprised by in terms of the levels of Staph aureus or MRSA or any of these fecal indicator bacteria?
We were surprised to see high amounts of fecal indicator bacteria at Reed Bay and Pui Bay. Since these beaches are really popular sites for swimming and even paddling or paddle boarding for, you know, the community in Hilo. And we were surprised to see high abundances of the fecal indicator bacteria there, especially since Reed Bay, for example, doesn't have as high of an abundance of on-site sewage disposal systems near that beach location. So within a 1 kilometer circumference of Reed Bay is about 30 on-site sewage disposal systems. But for Pui Bay, there's 100. So more expected for sites like Pui Bay, it was still surprising. But for Reed Bay, it was definitely a shock to see as high of fecal indicator bacteria concentrations at that site.
And did you share these results with DOH?
I have given this presentation and shared this paper with the administration at the Hawaii Department of Health State Laboratory Division. But the limitation I've commonly heard about adding even, you know, another indicator for water quality, even if we wanted to change what the fecal indicator bacteria are, is that it falls under the Environmental Protection Agency. So they basically decide what the states look for and monitor. And so I am hoping as a career goal that I can help improve what bacteria or even viruses or other indicators that we can use to more accurately indicate like safe water quality for those who are swimming in the coast and also even in like freshwater environments.
I'm wondering if you have advice or what you think Big Island residents should know about this study.
So some recommendations I would have for the community of Hilo is to never be afraid of going in and swimming, of course. People will ask me, like, do you still swim after knowing about these pathogens and the fecal indicator bacteria in the water? And of course I do. It's just knowing when the conditions are safe or not. So, and also understanding what sites may have higher concentrations. You will increase your risk of getting any sort of bacterial or viral infection if you're swimming with an open cut or an open wound. So, like rinsing off before and after swimming. I know a lot of beaches don't have these facilities present, but some, you know, for example, surfers will bring some water with them to wash off their body before and after. Since we can, as people, shed staph into our coastal waters as well.
I just wanted to thank you again for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you.
That was University of Hawaii at Hilo postdoctoral researcher Maria Stedman talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Stedman's recent study was published in the journal Water Environment Research. We'll have a link to it on our website after the show. We will also be on the Big Island tomorrow. We'll be hearing from the EPA Region 9 Administrator. We'll be talking about cesspools and sewage treatment plants, and we will be discussing more issues for Hawaii residents. Cultural considerations, what's its place, particularly when we're talking about a burial site of Hawaiian monarchs and close advisors? Such is the history of the Royal Mausoleum, Mauna Ala, which is located in Nu'uanu. Here to talk about the latest controversy that's swirling is HPR reporter Kuvehi Hirishi. Good morning, Kuvehi.
Good morning, Catherine. Yes, the saga continues over the curator position at Mauna Ala this week, with the Office of Hawaiian Affairs stepping in, saying it needs to intervene in the state's curator selection process because it appears to lack the cultural consideration necessary, as you mentioned. Mauna Ala has been the resting place of Hawaiian Ali'i since 1865. These grounds became the jurisdiction of the Department of Land and Natural Resources a little over 100 years later, and so it has been DLNR's job to find the right curator ever since. The majority of the 15 curators who have served at Mauna Ala since its inception have been descendants of families who have served Ali'i for generations. These include members of the Bekli Kahea, Taylor, and Maiohu Ohana. But last week, DLNR announced it would be breaking with tradition and selecting a curator with no known lineal ties to previous curator families. DLNR chose Dani Lena Alachong to serve as the new curator, and she made her debut at a press conference Friday.
Prior to the process, I sought to speak with the kupuna of the living descendants of David Kalakaua and Queen Liliuokalani Kalani. I went to them and asked them, is it okay if I even be considered to care for their iwi kupuna? They gave me their blessing, we prayed, and I continue going forward. For me, Mauna Ala is a sacred place, and if I may, I will refer to myself as the Royal Mausoleum Curator. I'm not a kahu. I consider that a very sacred reference. And as such, in all the things that I will be doing, until I gain that respect, I will call myself a curator.
I mean, it's interesting, right? I mean, in the past, Native Hawaiians would bury the ali'i like in caves, in secret places, and they wouldn't tell people, you know, where they were laid to rest. But now in modern times, we have a cemetery and we have, you know, this place. And we have some, like you said, traditions where it was the Maiohu family that, you know, was carrying the torch, caring for our ali'i.
Right. And, you know, Chong is a former Hawaiian Electric employee and says her cultural connection to Mauna Ala comes from her work with the Ka'ahumanu Society, one of our royal societies, where they do some groundskeeping, weed whacking, and help clean Ka'ahumanu and the rest of the Kamehameha Ohana's tombs there. We should point out that Chong was chosen over three other very strong candidates. This includes Kimo Keolana, who trained under previous curators, Kumuhula, Frank Kawai Kabokalani Hewitt, and James Maiohu, who, as you mentioned, is a descendant of that Maiohu Ohana who's cared for Mauna Ala for generations. DLNR's final selection began to sort of raise some questions about this process, the criteria considered, evaluation methods used. DLNR spokesman Dan Dennis said the agency is not at liberty to disclose information about the hiring process.
The new curator, Dani Chong, will not answer any questions about the selection process or other candidates. The Mauna Ala curator is a state employee governed by state employment laws. We do not reveal or discuss the selection process, interview panel, applicants, or qualifications and criteria for selection in order to maintain the integrity and sanctity of the state hiring process. For all of the above reasons, we are not at liberty to disclose the information about our hiring process. Dialogue between DLNR leadership with various individuals in the Native Hawaiian community continues.
So we'll
This prompted OHA to write a letter to DLNR over this past weekend calling for transparency in the selection process. This was OHA's second letter to DLNR in the last 2 months, raising concerns over the process and requesting consultation with the Native Hawaiian community. This is not the first group of Native Hawaiian leaders to request a meeting in light of the recent announcement. Last week, Wednesday, DLNR canceled media availability with the new curator to meet with members of the Royal Societies and Hawaiian Civic Clubs. We know that meeting was canceled due to weather, and of course, DLNR moved forward with the press conference. Dani Chong was not oblivious to the concerns over her selection, and she addressed it at last week's press conference. Here's Chong.
Going forward, this is a very special stewardship for this wahipana. I'm looking for what unites versus what divides us. I will always keep Keakua at the center and the forefront of all my decisions. Having the news conference here versus up there was intentional, because I do not want anything there that is not worthy of it.
Yeah, be interesting to see then what happens after this.
Right, as far as we know, Chong is still the new curator, and OHA's involvement, signals the potential for a meeting with the LNR leadership to
figure out a better process moving forward.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Kubehi.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking with HPR's Kubehi Hiraishi. You can read her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
The war in Gaza has caused divisions all over the world, including between American Jews.
I feel as a rabbi, a huge pastoral job to hold their hand through that moment and also guide them towards that compassionate light.
Hear how some synagogues are working towards compassion for everyone suffering from the conflict. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning this afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
Ever been frustrated at the DMV or on hold with the cable company? You've likely run into what psychologist Bob Sutton calls friction.
Friction fixing is sort of like mowing the lawn. There's no one and done with this sort of stuff.
Friction and how to fix it. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning tonight at 7.
Confest 2024 is a festival that celebrates Asian American and Pacific Islanders in theater. It's been around for nearly a decade and a half, and it's being held for the first time in Hawaii and kicks off this weekend at the University of Hawaii Manoa campus. Among the events taking place is a reading of the play, Fighting Like Mad. It takes place in post-wildfire Lahaina and was written by two Native Hawaiian sisters, Noelani and Mahealani Ahia. They both have lineal ties to Lahaina, but grew up in California before returning to Hawaii. The conversation's Russell Subiono talked to them about their play.
There's a lot of different thematic pieces running through that are all sort of slices of what we've experienced, Mahe and I. This is Noelani speaking. It's set post-fire in Lahaina, where I'm currently working, doing care work and post-fire relief. And it's kind of a story of these two cousins who are struggling with the housing situation, as most of the families in Lahaina still are, and they call out to their ancestor, you know, which is a common practice for our people to ask for guidance, and they reconnect with an ancestor from Lahaina. And I'll let Mahia share a little bit about that ancestor.
So the ancestor's name is Rose, and at the time she was young, she lost a baby and lost her lands at the same time and was declared mad or insane, as many women of that time were considered distressed, and was sent to the insane asylum on Oahu. And so it's a story of dispossession of lands and loss of life. And the young cousin, one of them is from Lahaina, born and bred, and the other is diasporic. So the diasporic cousin who comes home, who returns to Hawaii, is Hapai. She's pregnant. And so in calling out for help, the ancestor kind of guides her and gives her own miscarriage daughter, her own daughter's name. So she gets a name from the pole. And the child being born is a symbol of rebirth and reclaiming of life and land.
You know, there's so many nuanced things in this piece. It's only a 10-minute short play, stage reading, but we're looking at some of the political issues as well that are going on right now, like our indigenous midwives currently being criminalized for practicing, you know, their traditional cultural practice. And we're looking at the dispossession of land and learning more about putting people in the insane asylum during that time period was another way that the settler state used to dispossess Kanaka from our lands because folks were declared wards of the state, and therefore
they couldn't own land. They couldn't they couldn't be in charge of their own bodies.
Just like with Kalaupapa, when Kanaka were sent there, who weren't actually
didn't have
Hansen's disease. Yeah, you know, and then just these ideas about what's going on in Lahaina with the fire and people not having housing and the critical nature of the connection of Kanaka to Aina and how important that piece is in the healing of our people and the healing of Lahaina and the healing of Hawaii, really, to get Kanaka back on our land. And so that central theme of reclamation of land as well as healing. Birth and death cycles and healing.
What was it like for you both to write a play against the backdrop of an event that continues to impact so many people? Do you feel like you had to kind of tread carefully, or did you feel the time was right and it was important to tell these kinds of stories against the Lahaina backdrop?
This is Noe. I'll say, like, you know, we are not in any way trying to say that we speak for Lahaina. We do not. We are not born and raised there, although we are genealogical descendants. But I myself have been doing fire recovery work with the Maui Medic Healers Hui since the day after the fire. And my partner lived there, and I've done a lot of activist work there around burial protection and land reclamation. And so seeing what's going on every day and feeling the eha of our people and watching what's going on politically, and our people are being not taken care of the way that they should be. And as an advocate, part of what I do in my life anyways is speak up about these things. And when the opportunity, when my sister Mahia brought this opportunity for us to write a play, I just couldn't keep my mouth shut. I mean, we started talking about what we were going to write about, and it just poured out because it's really the truth and the reality. Although, you know, we took artistic license and, you know, moved some things in the timeline, but really it's reflective of my experience of what's going on there, my personal experience of what I've witnessed and participated in, and some of the stories that I've heard and that my own family has been experiencing. My partner lost his home in Lahaina. It was a very long, very old Lahaina family. And just watching the struggle that their family is going through is devastating. And using a platform like theater to be able to share this story, this mo'olelo, I feel like is a way that we can bring the truth out and honor it in a good way and in a way that provides some hope and a direction of restoration of Kanaka to Aina and Aina to Kanaka.
This is Mahia. I think it's really timely, and against the backdrop of Lahaina means that we can, as Noe said, we can speak truth. It's very rare that Kanaka get a chance to share our stories in this way, and live theater is often very expensive to produce, so we don't usually get to produce live theater very often. And there's something about, as opposed to movies, there's something about live theater where there's affect, there's emotions involved, and people who are in that room with you sort of go on a journey, and being able to take folks on a journey and see a side of Lahaina that they may not have seen. If you're only watching the news, it's not the top news story anymore. Other things have happened since then, but people may not realize that there are still so many families who have no home yet. They're still living in hotel rooms, and they're still trying to get back to their Aina, trying to put their families back together, having kids in the midst of all of this. And the birthing story is really important to our characters because the tutu was also a birth worker, just like the cousin is, who wants to help her cousin give birth in the traditional Hawaiian way, but right now it's illegal. So there's so many topical ideas there that folks are actually dealing with right now that I think the general public probably doesn't know about.
When we have these kinds of issues, it seems like story is one way that we are able to communicate the nuances of the issues. I know there's a lot of people who are processing trauma from the Maui fires. Can story help us to heal from those traumas?
Absolutely. So our mo'olelo are one of the carriers of our culture. And so, for instance, in our play, the tutu has passed on. And so we have sort of a spirit from the po who helps from the other side. And it is a way to actually remind us of our connections of both this world in the owl, the light world, as well as the po. And so those kinds of connections both to Aina and to our ancestors are critical to our health and healing. And the stories themselves are the vehicle to carry the emotion, to carry the movement, to carry the flow, to give the movement and the rebirth come through telling a story. And just like our ancestral origin stories, we're sort of creating an origin story for this particular generation of the rebirth of Lahaina with the child that is born. So with the cycle of life and death, the mo'olelo is the one way that actually births a new life into place.
Mm, beautiful, beautifully said, sister. Yeah. I'll just add to that, you know, because of the forced assimilation and the hyper-Americanization due to the illegal overthrow, my dad's generation, for example, they never saw themselves reflected in the stories of the mainstream. They never saw themselves. There were no plays where their own stories were reflected. And, you know, we're really grateful that we live in a time where, you know, we have a theater festival like this that is uplifting Honoko Maoli stories and Pacific Island stories and uplifting our mo'olelo so that our people can come to the theater and see themselves reflected and hear some of our own language and just be connected to in that way. And it's a form of validation for our people, and it's also a way to connect into that na'au, into a place where we feel things and know things and can process some of that trauma, you know, whether it's the historical trauma or the real-day, current, real-time trauma, which so much of us are going through. It's an opportunity for that to happen and for us to be validated and see ourselves in each other and in our story.
I think also, for instance, Rose's story, the Tutu story, is about being put in asylum. So these are some of those stories that have so much shame around them for our people, that it is a vehicle to help that healing, because we'll have the prompt to be able to talk about this. Things that we don't normally talk about that are supposed to, with the culture of silence, that no one wants to talk about these stories and what happened to our kupuna and the tragedies and the trauma that they endured. This is one of those ways that we can open up those conversations of things that people don't want to talk about.
Noi Lani, Mahea, thank you so much for your time.
Mahalo.
We've been hearing from sisters Noi Lani and Mahea Lani Ahia. They were talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about their new play, Fighting Like Mad. It'll be part of Confest 2024, a festival being held this weekend on the UH Manoa campus. We'll have a link to more information on our website later today. Well, that's it for it today. Tomorrow, we take the show on the road and broadcast from Hilo. Join us as we share Big Island stories. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The conversation is available as a podcast on our website or on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.